You're listening to a podcast from catholicchurch.org.uk.
Harry, you mentioned that 10% of Egyptians are Coptic Christians. Let's head back into North Africa now. Tell me a bit about the Christian experience over there.
North Africa, I mean, Egypt is definitely the example, James, where, as I said, roughly 10%, and that's quite a percentage, of the Egyptian population are Copts. Now, the large majority of those Copts are Orthodox Copts, but there are also Catholic Copts, and there are also Evangelical or Protestant Copts. But the largest number are the Orthodox Copts. Now, the problem with Egypt, again, is that those Copts face quite a lot of discrimination in their own country. And they do not have the freedom of worship and the freedom of expression in the way that we would understand it here in the West. They, for instance, constitutionally, a Christian cannot become a prime minister or president of the country. This is something that we might today, in the 21st century, find difficult in this country. But what also is more frightening is not so much that a Copt or a Christian cannot become a president or a prime minister in the country, but that a lot of those Copts are viewed with suspicion because they're almost looked at as a fifth column, as people who are not fully Egyptian because of their Coptic character and personality, because of the fact that they're also Christians and because of the fact that they somehow are looked upon by what I would call either political or ignorant Egyptians as being people who are not trustworthy. And life is very difficult for the Copts. I don't know how much your listeners are aware, but if you follow some of the news, you would come across different examples of forced marriages, different examples of abductions, different examples of pressure and oppression against the Copts, to such an extent that the Coptic Church, whose head is Pope Shenouda in Egypt, cannot build a church, cannot even renovate a church, cannot even do any structural change without the permission, the express permission of the president and the authorities in Egypt. I mean, that is how far the control is on those Copts. And this is part of the problem, part of the grievances of the Copts, that they do not enjoy the fundamental freedom for worship that they would wish to have. But in a sense, it's also very interesting because those who know Egypt and those who know the Coptic reality would also realize that there is also almost this dependency between a minority, in this case, the Coptic Christian minority, and the state. And this is something that you find in many parts of the world where a minority tends to gravitate around centers of power as a way of ensuring its own survival. And this also happens to some extent in Egypt. And this is where I see the paradox, on the one hand, of oppression sometimes, and on the other hand, this sense of gravitating around the state, which to some extent is the source of the problem. Yet, when you look in numerical terms across the Arab world, because you rightly placed Egypt in North Africa, but it is still considered as part of the Arab world, and most Copts speak Arabic perfectly, although their liturgy is different, it's in Coptic, you would realize that they are a substantial rump of the Christian presence in the Middle East, and this is why their voice is very important in terms of what happens to the future of Christians in that whole region.
Let's be a little bit challenging now. We spoke right at the very start about encouraging people, particularly from the UK, but those that don't normally go, Christians, encourage them to visit the Holy Land. Those experiences, not just the biblical sites, but experience with the people, stand in solidarity with the people. Now, a lot of people, particularly from this country, might find themselves heading off to Luxor. They might find themselves going to Cairo, to Alexandria. Do they really consider the plight of the Christians in Egypt? And should they?
No, they don't. Because, again, the plight of the Christians is an unknown factor to a lot of people. And when these people go to Luxor, go to Alexandria, go to different parts of Egypt, they go there more as tourists, more as touristic pilgrims, even if you would call them pilgrims. I would call them more like tourists. And we come back to the same fundamental issue, that how much time is spent by these people doing what I call responsible tourism. In other words, going and meeting, as a Christian, going and being interested, actively interested. There is an Anglican church in Egypt. There are many Coptic Catholic churches in Egypt. There is a huge Coptic Orthodox presence in Egypt. How many people actually take the time to go and meet these people, go to the different monasteries? I mean, the Coptic Christian tradition is a monastic tradition. It's a desert tradition. It's people who've lived in monasteries. How much of that is known, and how much of that plight is known? And when that plight is known to some people, what is done about it? This is the responsibility that I think we Christians carry, that it's not only a question of saying, yes, I went there, and you know what, I saw this funny Coptic priest wearing this black garb that looks quite funny from a Western perspective. I had a chat with him, and that was it. How much more involved are we with the life and witness of those Christians in the Middle East? That's the question that I always ask. And interestingly, every time I've gone to visit the Middle East, every time I've gone to see either grassroots Christians or church-related organizations or even churches and their leadership, and I always ask them, what do you want from us? What do you want from the West? What can we bring in terms of a qualitative contribution to your ministry and to your witness? And yes, of course, we get the standard answers, which are necessary answers, I think, given the realities of the region, like we would need your financial support, we would need you to arrange a visa for somebody to come and study at a university in the West. I mean, all these are practical realities. But the overwhelming answer is always, we need your solidarity, we need your support, we need you to speak out on our behalf. And this is where I see, again, perhaps a little bit too idealistically, I see Christianity as one body. A body has different limbs, has different organs. It's not one cell. I believe in the diversity, not in the uniformity. It's not just one. We're not all exactly the same. But we have our diverse traditions, we have our diverse approaches to our faith, yet there should be a unity. And that unity is made incarnate in baby Jesus, whose birth we're celebrating this month. And that is why I always urge people to go a little bit, just to challenge themselves a little bit beyond the very obvious, in order to see what is the reality in that part of the world, just as in any other part of the world, of the Christian communities living and witnessing there day in, day out, month in, month out, year in, year out. Now, you can only do this if you are interested in your faith, or if your faith compels you or challenges you to do that. This is not something every tourist going to the Middle East should do it. The overwhelming majority go there for the fun, the sea, the sand. But those of us who would like to help those Christian communities, or who would like to know a little bit more about those Christian communities, I mean, the Middle East Council of Churches is one example. There are a myriad other ways of getting to know more about them and also meeting with those people.
Harry, let's finish up by talking just a little bit about the Gulf states. We think expats, we think industry, finance. We don't think Christianity, do we?
No, we don't think Christianity, James. Actually, I didn't think Christianity much about the Gulf region until recently. In a previous life, I used to work as legal consultant to a patent and trademark firm of lawyers. And I was responsible for the whole Middle East, Gulf and North Africa. And therefore, I used to travel there all the time. And in the Gulf, it never actually occurred to me that there are Christians. But as my own faith developed, as it grew, and as I became more and more conscious in my own self about the realities of the Christian faith in the region, I suddenly began discovering that the Gulf is not as barren as we would think of it in faith terms. And one country that stands out, in my opinion, is Qatar. Now, when we talk about the Gulf, what do we talk about? We talk about the collapse in financial investments in Dubai. We talk about the other United Arab Emirates and Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, etc., which are basically building their lives on oil. But in Qatar, for instance, there is a proactive attitude by the political establishment, by the Emir of Qatar, to encourage Christians to build churches in Qatar, so much so that there is a part of Qatar, a little bit outside the center of the city, of Doha, the capital, called Church City, where different traditions, the Catholics have got a huge, what I would call a cathedral, already functioning there. You've got the Copts, we just talked about them in Egypt, who've got a church. Then there are the Anglicans who are building a church for the Anglican and all other Reform and Protestant traditions. All these people are building those churches, and it's very interesting because the Gulf is one area where, unlike all the other areas I just talked to you about, I cannot really talk of native indigenous Christianity. There are no Arab Christians of the Gulf region. Most of these people are expatriates, as you just said yourself, who are there working. So they're either from the West or from Philippines or from India or from other countries. Now, all these people need a place of worship, and the country is now accommodating those by allowing people to build those churches in order to be able to house them for worship. And in that sense, to me, this is an incredible departure from the stereotype. You mentioned stereotype a little earlier in another context. The stereotype of the Gulf is a very ascetic, hard, conservative, politically inflexible regime, which has absolutely nothing to do with Christianity or which wouldn't accept Christianity. I've always argued that we in the West should be open to Islam just as the Muslim countries should be open to Christianity. Now, Qatar is one area where that is happening, and the people I speak with who are overseeing this project and who are helping with the building of those churches are so excited by it because it's a learning curve, and it's not only a learning curve for all those Christians with their newly developed churches, but it's also for the country itself. The authorities have no clue of what a Christian is, what are our sacraments, how is a Christian marriage conducted, for instance. This is something that I know an Anglican pastor who tells me he has to go sit with the authorities and explain to them what is meant by a Christian marriage and how do we conduct a Christian marriage, and we need a certificate of marriage afterwards. All these are alien concepts to them. So the learning curve is not only for the Christians, largely expatriate there, but also for the country. However, given the realities of the region, given the tensions and persecution even sometimes that Christians face across parts of the Middle East, though not all, I think this is a wonderful bit of good news to share with your listeners just as we are celebrating the Christmas season.
Dr. Harry Hagopian, thank you for what I suppose we could call a tour of Christianity of the Middle East. Very much appreciate that. Now, just finally, for those that might be seeking a bit more, maybe they want to read a bit more, you have a website where you've got a lot of commentary and analysis called Epic Tarsis. First question, what does that mean? Second question, what's the web address?
Epic Tarsis, basically, people who go into my website will be able to see that it is taken from Greek and it's from Philippians. It basically means stretching out. And what I do in Epictasis in my website is to basically look at political issues affecting the whole of the Middle East, particularly what I call the three hot areas, i.e. Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, and Iraq. I look at those political issues, I address them from a faith prism. That is the way I look at it. So anybody who goes into www.epictasis, which is epektasis.net, this basically would, on the homepage, would explain pretty much why Epictasis, what is Epictasis, who am I for those who are remotely interested in who I am, and then a little bit about some of the articles I've written over the years. The website has got articles from 2000 onward, which include a lot of the pilgrimages of Pope John Paul II to the Middle East, as well as Pope Benedict to the region, plus other very hardcore political issues to do with justice, to do with discrimination, etc., etc. So I would invite your listeners to have a look at this website. But I would also add one thing, if I may. Whilst I've tried to share in a very condensed way, although it might sound that we've been talking quite a long period, I've tried to condense quite a formidable amount of material into just under an hour. So I only hope that what we have covered today would be helpful to the readers and listeners of your website. And I wish everybody a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And as the Arab Christians of the whole Middle East would say, Eid Milad Sa'id, which means Merry Christmas to you all.
Harry, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to a podcast from catholicchurch.org.uk.